All right. Our plan is to talk about Jewish mothers, not to the exclusion of any other mothers or any other women, but I think there are some specific things that we can think about after just observing Mother's Day yesterday. I guess we should start with a quick survey just to see what we're on the same page about and not on the same page about. So you can raise one hand or one finger or one foot. If we think that that parents, mothers and fathers, men and women, are equal. In principle. I'm not talking about in your own house. In principle, they're equal.
Yeah.
Equal?
Equal in what?
In their entirety. In their humanity. In everything about them. Are they equal?
Not entirely.
Not entirely? Okay.
They have different roles.
Okay, good. So they might be equal, but they might be different.
Not equal.
Oh, okay. Great. So this brings us to the second point. Even if you were to say that mothers, even if you were to say that mothers and fathers are equal, would anybody say that they're the same?
No.
No, definitely not the same. We all agree with that. And that's actually a big challenge now in America, because in the last couple of years, the concept of gender has undergoing a lot of changes, and it's literally on the news every day. And that's not to say that people who struggle with this challenge of gender identity, those are not real struggles. They absolutely are real struggles. But at the same time, certainly from a Jewish perspective, recognizing that men and women, mothers and fathers, they're different. They are, I mean, just look at us. Nobody else here looks like this during Spiras Omer. The recognition that we're different doesn't necessarily, at least from a Jewish standpoint, doesn't compromise the fact that they could be treated equally, which is, I think it's an important point. So when we're going to talk tonight about motherhood and mothers, it doesn't mean that these are character traits that are only found in women. They could be found in men also, but typologically, these are things that we will associate with the concept of motherhood and mothers, which is a difficult thing in society for people to get used to. Any lawyers besides Emily? I'll tell you why that's a problem for us, for Jews, not the lawyer bit. Brown versus Board of Education. Brown versus Board of Ed created a paradigm in America that says, what does it say? Anybody know? Separate but equal is not equal. So for that reason, if you were to come, let's say I daven in one of two synagogues in Skokie, and the men sit on one side and the women sit on another side, immediately, if you took a person just off the street and you told them that people are sitting separately, they will tell you that's unconstitutional. They would tell you that's not equal. But the way we view it is that to be equal, it doesn't mean you have to be the same. You can have, what was your line? Different roles? Yeah, different roles. So that's a big piece of it. And that's something that we try to instill as a value in our community, to appreciate the fact that people have different roles and that different people play different roles, irrespective, by the way, of the gender story. You know, have a lot of people who have different kinds of skills. So just because they're different doesn't mean they shouldn't be treated equally. It doesn't mean that they are equal to each other in terms of their own values. So that's one long, gigantic, huge introductory point, just so that people should not misunderstand that we're trying to discriminate. You know, we actually do discriminate all the time, but there's a big difference between discriminating between and discriminating against. In Judaism, we discriminate all the time between men and women, between whether you're a Kohen or a Yisrael. We discriminate between older people and younger people. We discriminate between, that's part of the Jewish community, but we never discriminate against anyone. Fair? And the segue to what we're talking about tonight, in certain respects, we have a lot to learn and a lot to draw from the mothers, from the women in the community, in the Jewish community, and in our own lives. And I'm not speaking about anybody's mother in particular, because I don't know, I mean, I know someone's mother in this room. We have a lot to be inspired by your mother, a lot. But everybody has a different mother, and I want to speak about typologically, about different things that we can learn, different aspects of mothers from a Jewish tradition standpoint that we can learn from, that we can be inspired by, and that we can inculcate into our own lives. So let's start with a billboard that I saw, and it's not the only time I saw this billboard, but it stuck with me the last time we drove from St. Louis back to Chicago. And besides for billboards, there isn't that much in between St. Louis and Chicago. And there was a giant billboard with a picture of a chicken coop. Now, I tried searching online for the picture of this billboard, but I didn't find it. Has anybody ever seen this billboard with a gigantic chicken coop? And the message is to dads, don't fly the coop. Be a dad. You ever see this? You ever see ads like this? So I went on the website of the Ad Council. You always see these things from the Ad Council. I don't know what those guys were or what they were doing. But they have campaigns, ad campaigns. And one of their campaigns is for fatherhood. They don't have a campaign to be a mother. Everybody, they got that down, apparently. The mothers got it. But the dads, on the other hand, they have a whole campaign, an ad campaign, for fathers to be fathers. And this billboard that I saw when we were driving was, don't fly the coop, be a dad. So what's behind that? What is that? Like, why is it that there is only an Ad Council campaign to be a father and not one to be a mother? What's the, any thoughts?
The father leaves, the mother always stays.
Okay, the father leaves, the mother stays.
The mother's giving birth, she has this obligation from the get-go. The father has to sort of choose to be...
Okay, the father has to choose to be involved.
Well, I know it's interesting that they do feel like father's involvement now seems to be more so than it was years ago. So it's interesting that there'd be, you know, the campaign that would be necessary. You know, I just came from standing in the ring of the baseball game, and there were like 5 moms and like 15 dads. All the dads were there. The moms were not wanting to be out in that weather. So it seems like there's more involvement. So it's, I don't know,
Right.
But I think the converse is true. Like, there's a lot more single mothers today than there used to be as well.
Right, and what they're talking about here, I think, is more than just whether the dads are going to the baseball game. Although that, when I went through the Ad Council, that's one of the big things they're talking about. With this ad, with the chicken coop ad, without getting too graphic, what I think they're really trying to say is, don't lay an egg on somebody else's coop and then leave. They're talking about dads who disappear before a mother ever gives birth. That's the dads they're talking about. But you see, there's this imbalance, there's this big distinction. There's no ad campaign to be a mother, because it's possible for a man to show up on the scene and leave right away, and he's out of the picture. But the woman's not out of the picture. The woman is cultivating and nurturing and nourishing this little person that's growing inside of her for 9 months. I don't know how wonderful that is or not. I'm sure it's a great experience. I've never had that. I've never had an epidural. I just like, it's great. But that distinction is a really important distinction to think about between mothers and fathers, and that we need a campaign to make sure that fathers are cultivators, that they stay around and make sure that somebody is in this chicken coop. Because the mother is going to be there, you need to make sure that the father is there. But it's the mother is hardwired, just biologically, that she's going to be a cultivator. So that's one important role that mothers have, and of course that doesn't just stop after the child is born. That continues on. And even this, the whole nurturing concept, it's a biological phenomenon. The Talmud has a discussion about this in regarding the laws of Yom Tov, where there are certain restrictions about handling animals. But one of the discussions, it's a practical matter. Anybody here own a farm? No. There are farms between here and St. Louis. But if you have an animal that's born on Yom Tov, so you have the calf that's birthed on Yom Tov, so there is a whole discussion about handling the calf so you can bring it close to the mother animal, to the mother cow on Yom Tov, so that they can develop that sensitivity, so that the mother cow can feel the calf right after it's born. Even though, generally speaking, you don't handle animals, but there are some exceptions when the animal is born, because the mother, it's not just when the the fetus is in utero that the mother is nurturing, is cultivating. That's the role of the mother, generally speaking. And that's why, if you look at it symbolically, so you can take the word man, ish, and you can take the word isha, a woman, and they have the same three letters, except each one has one distinction. The yud is one dot. It's one seed. And the hay is almost like a house. It's a building. And the Talmud says that God created both worlds, the world to come, the upper worlds, and the earthly world, the world that we live in, with two different letters. The letter yud and the letter hay. So the terrestrial world that we live in is created, it's built on the letter hay. Because that's the world of the cultivator. You know, it's not the idea of, you know, drop a spark of an idea and run. No, it's about nurturing it over time. Maybe that's why, in English, you have an expression, it's called Mother Earth. Ever heard that expression? It's never called Father Earth. Even though, usually, again, depending, again, I'm not speaking about particular families. You may have had a mother with a very green thumb. But when I was growing up, it was my dad who was outside with us, you know, like, digging. But it was never Father Earth, it's Mother Earth. Because, what's that? Mother Nature. Because the natural world, the cultivating aspect of life, that's represented by the woman. That's a Jewish concept that plays itself out in so many different aspects of life. But it's ingrained, and you need two parts of that puzzle to have a proper marriage. You need an Ish and an Isha, and the name of God, Yud and Hey, is formed in that entity that comes together. But it's the woman. If you don't, you can have somebody throwing seeds in the backyard from today till tomorrow, but unless you have somebody who comes and carefully makes sure that they land where they belong, and then they get watered, and somebody takes them to their soccer practice, and somebody takes them to their next thing, and somebody watches them, you know, in many cases, you're getting the 12 phone calls in that nurturing, in that cultivating role. So I think that's one important perspective. There's another perspective on mothers that we really appreciate. It's very, very powerful. And that's also hardwired biologically, but it's something that Jewishly we take very seriously. There was a tremendously enormous spiritual giant who lived in the Warsaw ghetto. His name was Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira. He was a rabbi in a small town outside of Warsaw, a Hasidic rabbi in a town called Piasecno, before he ended up in Warsaw when the war broke out, and then he became kind of like the spiritual mentor of many, many Jews in the ghetto. And he wrote, believe it or not, he delivered Shabbos sermons to the people, whoever was around, to listen to him in the Warsaw ghetto. And he has one talk where he talks about women and the model of women and why it's so important to look to women in their life in the ghetto. It was written in a summer Shabbos, in Parshas Sukkos. And he talks to the people in the ghetto. He says, you know, we face a big challenge here. What's our challenge? He says, our challenge is not so much that we're being broken and murdered and killed. He said, our challenge is that we may become callous. We may lose our sympathy for others. He says, and that's a terrible thing. Because he says, when you see so much destruction, so much suffering, so it's easy to become callous, because that's going to be your defense mechanism. How do you deal with all the terrible things that are falling down around us? So he says, you know what we need to do? We need to look to our Jewish mothers. Because the Gemara has a fascinating story. The Gemara tells a story. The Talmud relates that there was a great Jewish king. His name was Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu was, so to speak, like a reformer. Because when he came into power, he was a boy king, and basically everybody was completely assimilated. Nobody observed the laws of the Torah. They didn't even have Sifrei Torah. One guy found a Sefer Torah in the Beis HaMikdash, and they were like, whoa, what's this? You need to get somebody to read it. And they read the Sefer Torah, and they were like, wow, we have a lot of serious problems here. We got to straighten the society out. So who are we going to call? Well, if you're living in the First Temple period, you call a prophet, right? Good idea. Now, there happened to be a prophet at that time. His name was Jeremiah Yirmiyahu. That's a pretty big name, pretty good person to call, right? If you had to make a phone call to a prophet and you were the king, you probably would have called Yirmiyahu. But the Gemara says they did not do that. The Gemara says that they called Huldah. Huldah was a woman who was living at that time, who was one of the seven chief prophetesses. So this woman gets a call from the king. We need help because the people are, you know, spiritually wasted. She's like, of course, I know that. I'm a prophetess. But she comes to give them some advice about how to follow the Torah. And the Gemara, the Talmud, asks the question, wait a second. If you had one bat phone and one phone call to make, why would you call Huldah and not Jeremiah? Yirmiyahu is one of the most famous prophets of all time. If you took a survey of people like on the metro who were Jewish, most of them would have heard, you know, of Yirmiyahu before they would have heard of Huldah, the prophetess, let's be honest. So why would he call this? So the Talmud says one sparkling idea. You know why? Because the Gemara says, Ki nashim, women, rachmanios. They have compassion. So when you're looking at a situation of spiritual desolation, you need to figure out how to deal with these people, you need to call a woman. Because the woman will have the heart, the compassion, how to deal with these people. So it's better to call Huldah, who's kind of like an unknown figure, not unknown, but relatively unknown, than it is to call her cousin, Yirmiyahu. Said the Pious Etzner Rebbe to these remnants of the Jewish community in Warsaw. He says, you know, we need to call Huldah. He says, we need to look at other people and make sure we have that compassion. We have that rachmanus. That's a Jewish expression, rachmanus. The word rachmanus comes from the word rechem. Rechem in Hebrew means womb or uterus. It's hardwired for a woman to have rachmanus, to have compassion, to have sympathy for others. So that's another major aspect of a Jewish mother. Jewish mothers are, you know, in the world of comedy, they're always portrayed as overly worried about that we're not eating too little, that we're eating enough, that we have enough sweaters, that we have enough socks, because they're hardwired for rachmanus. That's the whole nature of a woman, is to be compassionate, to be caring about other people. That's, I think, a second. We're going to go through five, if we're still standing by the end. If Amy's still up, then that's a good sign that the rest of us are still up. All right, let's get to number three. Here's the quick survey. Free association. If we had a blackboard here, which we can imagine this is a blackboard, free associate between the following two terms. Let's start with house. What words come to mind when you think of house?
Well, I just want beautiful.
Okay, beautiful.
Sorry.
Great.
Cozy.
Shelter.
Cozy.
Maybe cozy. Okay. Protection, tax benefit, I have here on this survey, tax benefit, mortgage, right?
I was thinking a lot of work.
Decorating.
A lot of work, mortgage, credit, expensive,
money pit,
diversification. Okay, now let's try this side. Home,
family.
Love, kind of great.
Cozy over to the home side.
Yeah, okay, we're moving cozy.
Warm.
Family, they have here. Safety, security, privacy. So, the Talmud has a fascinating statement in a very unexpected place. The first Mishnah, the first section of the Tractate Yoma, which deals with the laws of Yom Kippurim, of Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol, who is the high priest, he has the central role. He serves as the main actor on the Yom Kippur stage. So he's doing all the sacrifices, all the services. And the Talmud says they had to prepare for a whole week to get ready for this. And there is one opinion that says that he had to have all kinds of contingency plans, what might happen to him. So they had all kinds of backups. And one opinion suggests that actually they would need to have a second wife lined up for him. We have to marry a second woman the week before Yom Kippur. I don't know who that was and who was volunteering for that job, but let's just leave that aside for a second. Why would he need a backup wife? Well, I can think of many good reasons, but the Gemara says, well, wait a second. The verse says that when the Kohen Gadol would recite the Vidur, the confession, when he would focus on the things that they needed atonement for, the first time it was Ba'ado, for himself, Uva'ad Beiso, and for his house. And the Mishnah says, Beiso Zu Ishto. His house, that's his wife. And the Talmud says, well, if he's not married, he can't serve as the Kohen Gadol, because he has to have a bias. So when you see that, you can look at it in two ways. The first thing you could say is, aha, you see that Jewish women for all of eternity are prescribed to only be homemakers, because it says, Beiso zu ishto. You could say that. But you could probably say something else. You could probably say that there's a big difference between a house and a home. The Kohen Gadol doesn't need a wife to be his bias. What do you mean? He can get a carpenter, he can build himself a house. But understandable is that Beiso, which is, this is not the only place this is referred to in the Jewish tradition, a bias in this context does not mean a house. It means a home. So, in again, typologically, the appreciation, tax benefits, diversification, collateral, place to work, leverage, credit, mortgage, and all the other things that we said about a house, those are one domain. But you need someone who can take that, and it's not easy, and it takes a lot of talent and love and care and concern to transform that into family, hobbies, friends, neighbors, relaxation, privacy, security, home, a bias. A bias is a home. It's not a house. A house is a structure. So every Jewish mother is the homemaker. That's what Chazal referred to as Akeres HaBayis. She's the mainstay of the house. Now, in our house, it happens to be a little bit different because when we moved here, my role in the kollel was very, very time-consuming to the point where all of a sudden none of the bills were being paid and none of the house components were being taken care of. So my wife does both the house and the home components. She does all the bills and everything like that. But in many homes, it's the dad who does the mortgage and the tax benefits and diversification. And it's the mom who does the family and the neighborly and all that kind of stuff. And so if you think about on Mother's Day from a Jewish vantage point, like what that means, that's really very significant, especially when it comes to children. Those who have children in their house, you can't raise children in a house. You can only raise children in a home. So this is, I think, a third way of looking at it. So I brought some, you know, you could take a look at these. I want you to have them because you can look at it afterwards for the other side. On the front page, you see we got through, we're already 60% done. See? No one painted yet. No one fainted. If number one, we talked about
paper.
What's that?
I like to use paper.
You got it. Every detail matters. So we talked about the cultivator. That's the best picture of a chicken coop I could find with the yod and the hay. We talked about the sympathizer, where the Talmud says in Megillah, Mipnei Shehanashim Rachmanio, saying that women are compassionate. We talked about the homemaker, Beiso Zu Ishto. And I like this quote. A house is made of bricks and beams. A home is made of hopes and dreams. Ah, that's beautiful. It's great on pink paper also. It's a great Hallmark card. You know who got paid to think of that. Okay, but here's number four. And this is an unbelievable source that I'm going to volunteer somebody if they don't want to volunteer to read. This is from this is incredible. This comes from a very important eulogy. It was delivered in, I think it was 1977. It was published in Tradition, which is an important rabbinic journal. It was authored by Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, who was one of the preeminent rabbinic figures of the 20th century. He was living in Boston, great city, Boston. And he has a daughter, Atara, who was at that time was married to an amazing figure. He was a prominent Harvard professor and also a Hasidic rabbi. Not often combined, but in this particular individual it was. His name was Dr. Isidore Twersky, also known as Rabbi Yitzchak Asher Twersky. So this Rabbi Twersky, Dr. Twersky, he was from a heritage, from a long line of Hasidic rabbis from a Polish town called Tolna. So his father was the Tolna Rebbe, and after his father died, he became the Tolna Rabbi, and his mother, the Mrs. Rivka Twersky, Rebecca Twersky, she was the Tolna Rebbetzin. So that means that she was the Machatenister of Rav Soloveitchik, so his son-in-law's mother. So when she died in the 1970s, he delivered a eulogy in her memory, and he published it. It's beautiful. There's nothing better to say about anybody's mother than what you'll find in this eulogy that one of the greatest rabbinic figures ever said about Mrs. Twersky. It happens to be that this family is one of the most prominent, very, very prominent in rabbinic families, the Soloveitchik families. So the Tversky family may be known to you because this Dr. Isidore Tversky had a son, Rabbi Moshe Tversky, who was a prominent rabbi in Har Nof, who was murdered in Shul 2 years ago. You may have heard his name. So this Rabbi Soloveitchik, it was his grandson, Rabbi Moshe Tversky of blessed memory. Rabbi Moshe Tversky was murdered in Har Nof a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. So here we have what Rav Soloveitchik is describing is Toras Imecha, the teachings of the mother. So who wants to read first? We'll take turns for the paragraphs. Someone's going to be called on if you don't volunteer. So it's in English also. That's why I feel like it's a fair thing. Go ahead.
What is Torah in the past? What kind of Torah does the mother pass on? I admit that I'm not able to become precisely
Masoretic.
Masoretic role of the Jewish mother. Only by first becoming Christian, the ritual of the planet, permit me to draw upon my own experiences. You said long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use a halakhic term in order to answer the question. She talked mi'inyana diyoma.
Which means, from the issues of the day.
I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the sigil every Friday night. And I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much.
Perfect. So now we're framing this as, here you have one of the most important rabbinic figures of the last 100 years, talking about his experience with his mother. His mother, her name was Pesia Soloveitchik. Her maiden name was Feinstein. There was a great rabbinic luminary who lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. His name was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was a cousin of Rav Soloveitchik because Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother was a Feinstein. She came from a rabbinic tradition. Her father was Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein. And they were from a very warm, kind of like rabbinically fuzzy kind of family. And his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, was the son of Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, a very austere, rigid Lithuanian type of family. So his parents were these kind of two archetypes that he's about to describe. You want to keep going or you want to pass the baton? Go for it.
Most of all, Rabbi, Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance.
Okay, now you're about to get to the most dramatic part, so read it like your life depended on it. Here we go.
Most of all,
here we go.
That Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience.
Uh-huh.
She taught me that there is a flavor, a sense, and warmth to these both. I learned from her the most important thing in life.
Wow, okay. You're about to learn the most important thing in life from Rav Soloveitchik. Go ahead.
Feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teaching, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They are a part of Musar Avikah. The Shabbat, as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is a part of Torah Imakeh. Fathers knew much about the Shabbat. The mothers lived the Shabbat, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to visit the Shabbat. Mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbat and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence.
Thoughts?
True. Yeah. It's totally true.
This should be, I feel like, the bumper sticker of every Jewish family. To feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. That's unbelievable. That's the goal of being really connected with God on a regular basis. To be enveloped in that kind of environment. And whose responsibility is that? Whose opportunity is that? Who creates that? That's the mother. Again, it's typological. You'll have this also. It doesn't mean that he, Rabbi Soloveitchik, was a dry being, dry soulless being because he wasn't his mother. It means that's what he took from his mother. That's what he learned from her. That's what he brought into his own personality. But this is really important. This is really the character, that experiential aspect of Judaism. I call it, in point number 4 here, the experiential educator. So that's crucial. The role that the mothers play in the experiential aspect of Judaism is major. You know, today it's very popular for people, I've never done this, but people, they travel to Eastern Europe, to Poland, for trips like March of the Living. How many people have done this? You did it? Anybody else?
Yeah.
You've heard people do this all the time, right? Birthright?
Yeah.
Birthright is big. Birthright is so big, right, is Israel. Birthright is so big that tonight on NPR, on my way here, I learned about a program that Cuban Americans in Miami are creating to bring Cuban Americans to Cuba because they learned about Birthright. I'm serious. Yes. They learned about Birthright, and this guy, this Cuban American, was on the radio talking about how affected his friends were when they went to Israel on Birthright, that he said, we got to do this for Cuban Americans to go to Cuba. And that's what they're doing. So here's my question. Why? Why did these guys from Birthright spend all this money? I bet we could have bought, for the same amount of money, we could have bought the best books anybody could have ever read about Israel and given them out for free and saved everybody the time and the money. And the same thing, I can tell you from my experiences studying about the Holocaust, there are a lot of great books out there, very powerful books. So why do people bother to schlep halfway across the world to sit on a bus and drive through graveyards in Poland? It's the best way to learn. You know who figured that out? The rabbis who organized the Seder figured it out. You want to teach your kids about Judaism? Don't sit them down and give them a lecture. Give them something to eat, to feel, to smell, to touch. Isn't that what teachers do? That's why the Seder is all about experiential learning. And that's why we say at the Seder, Rabbi Gamliel said, if you didn't say Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, if you didn't put it all together, you didn't make it happen. Because you can have somebody who's in your classroom who's making the projects, but if you didn't understand what the projects are about, the same thing. You could be talking about the Seder, but if you don't have the matzah, you're missing out. You got to have the whole thing together because it's about the experience. It's about the experiential learning. That's why they're going to Poland. That's why the Birthright guys are going to Israel. They're taking these men and women to Israel because they know there's nothing like standing at the Kotel. You can read about the Kotel from today till tomorrow. That's the reading about it. That's part of Musar Avicha. That we can get in a book. That's knowledge. That's what he calls, you know, you can know about Israel. But when you go on Birthright, you live Israel. That's the difference. And that we give to our mothers. One last. Here we go. And we'll call it the faith builder, but it's more than that. This is a Mishnah in the end of Maseches Kiddushin. What happens in a case of intermarriage? So the Mishnah says, V'chol mi she'en la lo alav v'lo al achirim kiddushin havlad kemosa. Whether or not a child, according to traditional Judaism, is Jewish, follows the mother. That's what the Mishnah rules. So if you have a couple, and one part of the couple is Jewish, and the other part of the couple is not Jewish, depending on whether or not it's the father or the mother, that will dictate, according to traditional halacha, whether or not the child is Jewish or not. So isn't that interesting? When it comes to, let's say, you know, there are 12 tribes. When it comes to figuring out what tribe you are, that goes by your father. But to figure out whether you're Jewish or not, that depends on your mother. That's a pretty significant role, I would think. No? That's like huge. That's like the first thing to figure out in the morning. Like, am I Jewish or not? Right? So who do we leave that with? We leave it with the mothers. We got it. No problem. Mothers, they're first in line. They're responsible for that. So why is that? So there are legal reasons why that is. But what's the philosophical underpinning? What's the message? What does that have to do with me and with you? So there is something about the mothers and women in general that has to do with the core of who we are as a people. And that determines whether or not a person is part of the Jewish people or not. Now, that doesn't mean you can't join. You know, it was great. This was awesome. I went a couple of weeks ago when we were with Pesach with my in-laws' family. So my wife, Nechama, her grandparents, her grandmother and her husband, they come to spend Yom Tov with us. And thank God, they're really amazing people. He's over 90 years old and he flies down to Orlando. So I had the privilege of going to the airport to pick them up. But their flight came in, it was like 7 o'clock in the afternoon and it was almost sunset and there was no way we were going to get back to Daven Mincha before sundown, so we had to daven. But he's wheelchair bound, so it's like a complicated story. So we just stood there next to the car at the arrivals area on the street. We didn't get a ticket for praying at the arrivals area, but we basically stood there next to the car and we just daven mincha. And there was like a middle-aged African-American woman in a wheelchair who, when I finished saying Shmona Esrei, called me over. I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm very excited about this. Most people would think that's weird, but I'm like, let's hear, what do you got? So she was very excited that we were praying. She thought that was great. It was beautiful. And then she asked me, she says, you know, could I join? Could I be Jewish? I'm like, sure. She's like, really? I'm like, yes. Just find your local rabbi. And you can go through the process of conversion. Just because you're not Jewish today doesn't mean you can't be Jewish tomorrow. Now, I don't know what she did with that, because we left, we went home. And she was still there waiting for someone to pick her up at the airport. So it's not true that the only way to be Jewish is if your mother is Jewish. It's also possible to join the Jewish people. We're not an exclusive club. But the idea that we are Jewish because our mothers are Jewish is really very profound. If you look on this little box, the word Aleph Mem is the word aim, like Ima. Some of us call our mother Ima. But it also, if you break it out a little further, Aleph Vav Mem He spells Uma. Uma is the nation, the people. So the Uma comes from the same letters, it's exactly the same letters as aim, as your mother. But if you open it up even a little further, it spells emunah. What is emunah? Belief. Or even more precisely, it means the experience, as Rav Soloveitchik said, the experience of feeling the presence of God. So with everything put together that we said tonight, I can understand very well why it's up to the mothers to pass on the whole Jewish identity to their children. Because to create a nation, you need cultivators, right? You need that, what we started with. You need that hay that's going to be more than just drop the seed and run. You need someone who's going to form and shape. You need the experiential component. To create that emunah does not really mean something that's cognitive. It means something that's a feeling. That's why the word emunah and the word omein are related. A nursing mother is referred to as an omenet. Again, the same word, aleph vav mem nun, omein, is to be a nurturing mother. A nursing mother is called an omenet. So emunah comes from the nurturing relationship that we have with Hashem. And that comes from our mothers. So if you want to know, at the end of the day, you know, what's the most important thing in life, Rav Soloveitchik said, to feel the presence of the Almighty. And that, we're not going to get that from a book. You're going to get that from a living experience. We're going to get that from the role models. We're going to get that from our mothers who have that compassionate quality. They build the bias, the letter beis, which is the bias, that's the backbone of everything. The Torah begins with the letter beis. It doesn't begin with the letter aleph. Avraham, the first man, great idea. He's the, you know, the great champion of the initial idea, but it takes Sarah, who goes from the yud to the hey, as the cultivator, as the person who's going to be the first woman to be the mother of the Jewish people, to cultivate that idea. You know, otherwise, Avraham Avinu probably would have come on to, you know, he would have gone on the next idea, probably until Sarah had just sat him down and straightened him out and figured out what needed to be done. You know, it's a lot of great ideas Avraham had. But it was really Sarah, even Avraham himself, needed a hey to follow in that mold of building. So I think these are some of the things that we can appreciate when we talk about great Jewish mothers and the things that we have to learn and be inspired by for our own lives and live up to. These are a tall task and something that we can take with us, hopefully. So thank you for listening, and I hope you had a terrific Mother's Day yesterday.